Larry Burns is a longtime director of the Council on Hemispheric Affairs, or COHA, and the person I go to when I want to find out what's going on in Latin America. On my last program, we started a conversation about developments in the region which are exciting and important, providing some bright spots in an otherwise depressing world. And we will continue with that discussion today. So welcome, Larry. Well, let's start with the election of Rafael Correa in Ecuador. He scored an impressive victory after losing in the first round. How did he manage to turn it around?
Well, of course, that's an amazing story, and one which we really don't completely understand at this point. But I was convinced he'd lose. In fact, we started drafting it. Statements based upon his losing. He lost the first round by a couple of points, and he was supposed to win the first round, according to the polls. The second round, that is the one that just took place, he was supposed to lose. In fact, he was supposed to lose big by some polls at 7 or 8 points. In fact, he got 57% of the vote, which is an absolute runaway tally for him to have obtained. So you have to speculate why he won, and I think one of the reasons why was the nature of his opponent, a man named Noboa. And Noboa is an interesting man. He's a very nice man. He has over $1 billion, maybe because of that. He's also a banana king. Ecuador is a major producer of bananas, in fact, one of the world's largest producers of bananas. And no one could ever accuse Noboa of paying his workers a living wage. Yet during his campaign, and that fact was well known because he has lost repeatedly in running for the presidency, he felt that it was his civic duty to be the president. The nation needed him. And he would sort of carry on such antic behavior as passing out $500 bills or giving people receipts to pick up a new computer. It was all based upon a kind of populism stood on its head. He was described as a populist leader, but what he actually was a person who decided he'd buy himself the presidency. The only thing is that the Ecuadorian electorate is extremely unpredictable and very volatile, and also a new element has come into play with the rise of the indigenous population, who have become a real factor in the country and are responsible for several presidents being ousted from office. So this is, of course, being heavily celebrated in Caracas, because unlike what has happened earlier in Peru and in Mexico, where Hugo Chavez, Venezuela's president, proved to be a kind of poison pill for the like-minded candidates running in those countries, and the invocation of the Chavez factor is generally believed to be was instrumental in the victories of Garcia in Peru and Calderon in Mexico. So in the case of Ecuador, Correa actually campaigned on his friendship with Chavez, and said he'd like to create a Chavez-like country in Ecuador. This apparently meant emphasizing the plight of the poor, and Correa relentlessly maintained that campaign, identifying with Chavez, and at the same time, of course, everyone knew that he was an extremely well-educated man, that he had been finance minister in the previous government for a few months, and that he was well-equipped to be a very serious president. And apparently the majority of the population by far decided that Noboa wasn't a serious man and didn't deserve to be president of the country.
Well, this almost a 2-1 victory of a Korea based on his alliance with Chavez, and also the fact that Ecuador is an oil-producing country with a history of exploitation by Western oil companies, really strengthens the move, which has been growing, what you call the pink tide in what's called the pink tide in Latin America. It was a stunning defeat for Washington.
A huge defeat for Washington, absolutely huge. Washington thought it had done things right, because whereas in Nicaragua with Daniel Ortega, where the U.S. Ambassador, Paul Trevelli, there, directly intervened in the election, brought together all of the conservative candidates in order that they would create a solid front. In Ecuador, the State Department tried to keep its hands off the election. At the same time, Noboa spent probably three or four times more money on this election than was the case with Korea. So the situation here was one that Korea's victory provided the pink tide with a huge momentum, and was very much a personal victory for Chavez, who, curiously enough, did not actively participate in the campaign. It was Korea's initiative that kept on stressing the connections between Venezuela and Ecuador, and not Chavez, because Chavez didn't want to be accused again of bringing down a like-minded candidate. Now, the State Department is not going to be able to explain away this victory. And the pink tide, which really represents a type of New Deal type of reformism, is very much in ascendancy right now. And the administration, distracted by Iraq, has no effective way of really dealing with this. So they essentially are just hoping that this bad news goes away fast. But unfortunately for the department, I think that the discussion of the Korea victory is going to go on and on and on.
Well, it also means, according to Korea, that a U.S. military base down there is going to close, that's supposedly being used to impede drug traffickers.
Yeah, I'll tell you something about that. A couple of years ago, we put out a press release about the Manta base that you're referring to on the coast of Ecuador. I was telephoned by someone from the Southern Command at the Pentagon, and a colonel who wants to come over and chat me up, and I said, sure, I love colonels. He came over and he said, you know, you misunderstand this. This base is not really a base. It has dirt runways. It says we probably spend $100,000 a year on the whole operation. Basically, we land there to get provisions and take off, and it's entirely for drug surveillance work, and this one you don't have to worry about. So I stopped worrying, at least for the next 2 days, and then I received a phone call from that very colonel. And he said, well, you know, I'm terribly embarrassed by this call, but I just read the appropriation request for next year, and our dirt runway airport is now going to be getting a $15 million concrete, one of the longest in all of Latin America. And rather than temporary overnight facilities, or no overnight facilities, which the current base had, we're building a very complex infrastructure there. So this also had to do with Rumsfeld's, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld's dream of reawakening of the ties that connected the Latin American military to the United States, and that there would be these small bases, aside from big ones, like in El Salvador and in Ecuador, there would be small bases. In fact, Rumsfeld called them lily pads bases, because they were very small and you could barely notice them. And that these would be in the Caribbean and in Central America. It would not prove very costly. Well, you add this all up, and you see that the Bush administration actively was considering a major expansion of U.S. Latin American ties via their military establishments, essentially based on acting as a countervailing factor against the rise of these pink-tied nations.
Well, it's interesting that it seems that the only solid, and I use the term loosely, ally that the United States has in Latin America at the moment, or in South America, is Colombia, which is the third largest recipient of military aid and economic aid after Israel and Egypt.
Yes.
What does this do to Colombia's position?
Well, of course, Colombia's very interesting, and you'd also have to say, if you're including all of Latin America, that El Salvador is a great friend of Washington, has sent troops to various places where the United States has wanted them to go, including Iraq. Of course, South Korea is very much hostage to the United States because of it very much wanted the Central American Free Trade Agreement so it could export its textiles to the United States. And also, $5 billion a year is shipped down to El Salvador by Salvadorans living in the United States in form of remittances. And that $5 billion is larger than any other single export on the part of that country. So the United States was well aware of the fact that El Salvador was a lapdog nation due to its economic exposure to U.S. influence. In terms of Colombia, a number of months ago, I was reading something about President Uribe, Alvaro Uribe, conservative president of the country, and you're quite right, under Plan Colombia, Colombia has been receiving anywhere from $1 billion a year to $650 million a year, but big money, and the money pretty much equaled what the entire rest of Latin America was getting from this country. And ostensibly, these funds were being used to cope with drug trafficking. Well, actually, beginning with under Clinton and certainly expanding under Bush, more and more of these funds went into providing infrastructural assistance in fighting the two leftist guerrilla groups in the country, the ELN and the FARC. But even Uribe doesn't want to be pushed around by the United States. And when a couple of months ago the Colombians were able to kidnap from Venezuela a FARC official who was sort of getting R&R in Venezuela, and the Venezuelans were furious about the Colombian participation in this kidnapping. Pastor Witter said, we're prepared to back Colombia every inch of the way. Now, President Uribe's response to that was, no one asks you to butt into our business, to butt into our affairs. This is what he responded to the U.S. ambassador. And in fact, he very quickly arranged for a presidential summit conference between himself, Uribe, and Chavez. The two of them met, and the situation was complicated. But you can notice that the United States was itching to use this incident as a trigger to escalate the antipathy between Colombia and Venezuela. But what the U.S. ambassador didn't reckon with was the fact that in recent years, a very significant bilateral trade has developed between Colombia and Venezuela of over $1 billion a year of non-traditional exports. And Colombia knows, because it watched what happened with the Central American countries after the Central American wars in the 1990s ended, that aid to a country like El Salvador plummeted from $650 million to $60 million. And the Colombians realized that, that a long-term relationship with Venezuela was very important to them.
Well, in this case, the election also in Ecuador of Correa and the election of Morales obviously puts pressure on Uribe to stand up to the United States and be more independent. I'd like to shift to Mexico because in Mexico we see Calderon about to be inaugurated and Lopez Obrador has inaugurated his shadow government. And in Oaxaca, the scene of ongoing repression continue, and Comandante Marcos issued a statement saying we are on the eve of either a great uprising or a civil war, and of course Mexico is extremely important to the United States. How does it look to you from there, from Washington?
Well, it looks very bad, and in fact, because of the fact that there are going to be all sorts of dignitaries in Mexico when Calderon is inaugurated, and because of the fact that President Bush will be in attendance at that inauguration, and because of the fact that the man who narrowly lost, if you accept that interpretation, the presidential election to Calderon, the leftist candidate, López Obrador, that he's going to establish a parallel government, and he's going to inaugurate himself on the day that Calderon is inaugurated, which means essentially ongoing strife in the country. There aren't enough troops in the Mexican army to handle all of these situations. So it's a very precarious situation. And of course, Calderon is a different kind of guy than President Fox is, the incumbent president of Mexico. And in fact, Calderon has let it be known that the terrible decline in Cuban-Mexican relations that occurred under Fox, due to several specific incidents where Fox Castro and didn't treat him with much respect, ought to be helpful to the United States. Mexican relations with the rest of Latin America plummeted to an all-time low. Now, Mexico has only seen itself as a kind of interlocutor between Latin America and the United States. That position is totally demolished by Fox's almost obsequious deference to Washington on such issues with the immigration and free trade and but Calderon has announced the other day that reviving relations with Cuba is going to be the highest priority for him. Now, one of the problems that Fox had when he was president was that his foreign minister was a man named Jorge Castaneda, who was a man of the left in previous incarnations and had been an important figure in the PRD, that's the López Obrador's party, and had been rewarded by this surprising announcement by Fox that he was going to bring on board a non-panista, a member of his own party. Well, once Castaneda became foreign minister, he moved dramatically to the right and, in fact, became the active factor in promoting Fox as being very anti-Castro and very pro the U.S. Well, this whole episode terribly damaged, perhaps fatally damaged, Jorge Castaneda's profession of wanting to be president someday, and became kind of a very important issue in Mexico, because Mexico traditionally had insisted on having normal and correct relations with Cuba. So we don't know how Calderon is going to go. Remember, that the legitimacy of his election has been questioned, not only by López Obrador, but by the fact it was so close, it was so suspiciously close. Yet at the same time, close elections do occur, and López Obrador was never able to produce the absolute slam-dunk evidence that, in fact, the election had been stolen. And so the longer that López Obrador maintains the fiction that he, rather than
Calderon.
The other guy, Calderon, is the legal president of the country, he's going to continue to lose stature. People will find the whole gig to be somewhat tiresome. In other words, he doesn't have, Calderon does not have a sense of timing on this issue, if I understand the thing correctly. In terms of Oaxaca, this is an old PRI, the old party of Mexico, that ruled for 71 years as a result of phony election after another. And the PRI governor of that country, the governor of Oaxaca, is a an old-time poltroon of a man, and the indigenous population wants him out. And they say that he won the last election through fraud. Even his own party, the PRI, is beginning to look upon him as a major embarrassment. And they want him out as well. But Ulysses Ruiz is not going. So as long as he remains, these demonstrations are going to continue. It's become a matter of will. Ruiz is determined to stay, no matter what initiatives are undertaken to get rid of him. And the Zapateros are anxious to get him out.
Well, wasn't there some action or vote or statement made by the Mexican Assembly calling on Ruiz to resign?
Yes, all of them, that is, all the political parties, unanimously, I think it was the Senate, actually, the Senate asked for him to vacate the office. Because under the Mexican Constitution, if an official, a governor in this instance, cannot effectively carry out the charge of his office, the president is empowered to remove him. And that is the standoff that's taking place right now. Now, of course, this issue is of great importance to the United States, but they're not moving on it because of the traditional Mexican sensitivity about any form of intervention coming from Washington.
Well, given the elections in Latin America and the indigenous populations which supported López Obrador in Mexico, it would seem, whatever his personal wishes, inclinations might be, that Calderón's reaching out to Cuba and perhaps reaching out to Chavez and others in Latin America will be used in order to solidify his position and turn off the opposition supporting López Obrador.
Yes, that's a very good observation. And it brings in another element to this, because during the campaign, when López Obrador shamelessly was when Calderón was shamelessly accusing López Obrador of basically having become a satellite of Chavez. In fact, what he was saying was that Mexico, would be seeking to join Mercosur pact, which they joined, which is proven by Lula, the president of Brazil, and that Cuba would be coming into Mercosur. And we'll begin the process of becoming a member of Mercosur, which is a major, major development in terms of Cuba's relationship with the... Now, I am totally convinced that we are going to see an early initiative on the part of the Pink Eyed countries to lift the suspension of Cuba from the OAS. If that initiative takes place, the very strong message will be delivered here that Latin America is becoming increasingly inclined to be autonomous, that perhaps the United States should not be a member of the OAS, because, after all, the United States has very little in common with the rest of the region. But if this occurs, the United States would consider withdrawing, or any number of pro-voters would entertain them leaving the OAS rather than tending the suspend Cuba.
Well, since you're bringing up Cuba, I was interested to read one of the publications of yours about the health of Fidel and the future of Cuba after he's gone. Put out information of how Cuba is moving toward energy independence thanks to foreign investors, Venezuela and China, with oil and all. This seems a very significant development.
Huge. Big. Because what it really means is that Cuba increasingly is in a position to really thumb its nose at Washington, because the embargo will have proven to have no teeth. And that's an interesting concept of no teeth. Is very much interested in Cuba's potential as having significant amounts of offshore oil. Also, of course, Cuba is the world's largest, maybe right after Brazil today, but was, until recently, the world's largest producer of sugar. Now, harvests of 7 million tons a year were common. And last year, Cuba only had a harvest of 1.7 million tons. So Cuba is in a position to significantly expand its oil production. And there are French companies and Spanish companies and certainly Petrobras, the Brazilian state oil company, are there, are offshore, are drilling. Cuba also has onshore oil and produces about 80,000 barrels a day, which, because of the fact that Cuba is really a non-energy-based society, it has a very limited amount of electricity is produced, and of course, the odd consumer doesn't readily have a car. So, this is, and of course, Venezuela has almost a $3 billion a year in bilateral trade with Cuba, and Cuba will be receiving additional amounts of oil under the preferential policy of Venezuela, giving basically 40% discount to a select group of nations, largely poor nations in the region. But Venezuela is also cooperating with Cuba in terms of building refineries. And so there's a lot happening here, and none of it good for the status quo of the U.S. Oil policy towards Cuba. And so, in a sense, this is why the Cuban Americans in Miami, or that faction who loathe Castro, are becoming increasingly apoplectic, because Cuba will be potentially soon free of the incubus of this U.S. hostility and animus to the country. And at the very time when Cuba has never been more popular throughout Latin America and increasingly throughout the world.
It seems Fidel Castro has been ill and out of commission for some time, and with Raul at the helm and staying fairly in the background, it doesn't seem like that's had much of an effect on Cuba as people might have expected.
Well, one should have known that under any circumstances, the Cubans aren't going to hang out flags that will say, "Welcome, gusanos from Miami." This is not what they're going to do. It is, now, you can come forth with some random judgments. Let's start by saying this. I personally believe that maybe 15% of the Cuban population loathe Castro, and that 15% adore him, and that the rest are simply people trying to live out their lives shorn of politics, I mean, they just want to live that wonderful Cuban lifestyle every day and maybe eat better. Although that's a real prospect now with the increasing prosperity that Cuba is reflecting.
Well, we've got some calls on the line. Let's go to the first caller.
Okay.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm kind of sorry to hear this this information about Cuba. Cuba has been really a shining light in terms of their efforts to get off of the oil treadmill, and there's no real benefit to Cuba to developing oil. Let's face it, we're all facing global warming and all the other impacts of oil development. So it's very discouraging to see Cuba going down the same road, approaching the cliff that the rest of us. And so it's not. I mean, it's interesting to hear about it, but it's certainly not to Cuba's benefit. They're affected by hurricanes, forced by global warming, as well as anybody else in that region. So it's not to their benefit. To me, it demonstrates a real a wrong turn for Cuba to be sucking up to oil refineries and oil development. That's
Larry, care to comment on that?
Yes, well, I think it's a very high-minded perception. It should be said that Cuba also is experimenting and has lots of projects going with non-traditional alternative fuels and biomass, and they are going to, in a major way, they're going to pursue ethanol for their own interests, because of the fact that it's with the superabundance of sugar, and the sugar ethanol is far more efficient and inexpensive than corn-based ethanol, like the United States is considering developing. So Cuba has certain natural advantages here. But remember that we're not talking about a consumer society. China made the fateful decision recently to become a people will own cars. They're building the equivalent of the state highway system, the national highways, and gas stations all over the country, and they're becoming a very traditional consumer economy. Now, there is no way that Cuba is going to be able to duplicate that. It just doesn't have the resources, and it's not going to build highways. But people right now walk to work many miles, and there are all sorts of inefficiencies. For example, the Cuban Defense Force, Cuban military aircraft fly very limited training schedules during every month because of the shortage of fuel, and it becomes almost a bureaucratic decision whether a vehicle is going to be used for this purpose or not. So I can understand the position of the caller, certainly I can, but from the practicality of the rule of state, this has to be considered from a Cuban perspective to be good news at stage.
At one time there was a corridor supposed to go all the way from Alaska to the southern tip of South America. Wonderful idea, but it didn't work out too well. But I wonder if you can give me any information about the new one NAFTA's working on, working on McClellan, Texas, and heading on up to Canada.
You refer to the highway that's supposed to go right through the middle of the United States?
Yes.
Well, of course, there is a highway from the southern tip of South America. That's the Pan-American Highway.
Right.
There's only one gap there, and that's called the Darien Gap, which is between Panama and Colombia, where the San Blas Indians live. And, of course, the San Blas are opposing the construction of or filling in that gap, which would obviously have huge environmental potential since it's basically a very bosky area. Now, There's another plan, which is called Plan Puebla Panama. And this is largely hatched by Mexico with the help of U.S. public relations firms. And this is supposed to be a development card and so forth. But what it's going to do is it's going to penetrate the virgin forests in Central America, mahogany forests. And there's a very large environmental movement trying to fight this. It has the full support of Washington and the international lending agencies, because they speak of it in terms of they slap in the word sustainable, and so they say, well, we have sustainable development there. What they have really is they're going to have a superhighway going next to a Mayan ruin and probably stick a couple of gas stations around it. And many people are very, very apprehensive of that.
Thank you, Larry. One thing I wanted to touch on, which we haven't heard much of the news lately, is from Haiti. What's the situation in there since the elections took place? A supporter of Aristide was elected, and the question was whether President Aristide, before who was deposed by the United States, would come back. What's the latest news from Haiti that you have?
Well, unfortunate news. The news is that under President René Préval, a man who we all admired, nothing has happened. That the status quo, listen, Jeff, if you last checked in the Haitian issues 4 months ago, you are still an expert, because the regnant facts of life at that point still exist today. And that is, you have massive corruption. The UN peacekeeping force led by Brazil repeatedly has engaged in violence against pro-Aristide people. Of course, there's no prosecution of people who committed major excesses during the rule of Gerard Latour-Tour, the interim leader of Haiti, superimposed by the U.S. There's been no real discussion about Aristide coming back to Haiti. It would be difficult for him to do in terms of security. And just in terms of living standards, Préval has permitted people, political prisoners, dating back to the Aristide period, that is, when Aristide was forced to leave the country. Those people are still in jail. Provides me a disappointment.
That is a disappointment, because we expected something to happen, and then I see some communiques occasionally from there, but nothing positive. Maybe a prisoner here released. There was a Suan, a popular singer, released, but this is unfortunate. Well, I'm sorry to end this conversation on that depressing note. Larry Burns, Council of Hemispheric Affairs, www.coha.org. Get on their mailing list and find out what's going on in Latin America. Larry, I want to thank you again for being our guest today on Takes on the World and filling us in on what's going on. Because it is exciting down there, and I think we're going to get more excitement in the coming years, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Jeff, you are a true caballero.
compa, yes, very well. Thanks again for being our guest today, and look forward to talking to you in the new year, and the best to you.
Excellent.
In the new year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.